It's the Criterion. It's the Criterion. 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 And Criterion.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Criterion Project. I am Conrado Falco. Today we're talking about the movie The Host, directed by Academy Award winning, that's right, director Bong Joon-ho. But before we get into it, and before I introduce my lovely co-host and our wonderful guest, I want to be very shameless and plug my web series, Wormholes, which is available on YouTube if you go to the Show Dogs NYC YouTube channel, and also on Instagram if you follow at wormholes.tv. It's a science fiction comedy series that was created and shot all during quarantine by me and my collaborators, and I'm really excited to share it with you guys. I hope you enjoy it. It's a fun show. But now let's get into another fun show, which is the Criterion Project. As always, I'm joined by the lovely Rachel Wagner. Rachel, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, and I give my endorsement of Wormholes. This is a lot of fun. People should check it out.
Thank you. That means a lot. I'm really happy that you enjoyed it, Rachel. The reception has been so far very good, so we're very happy about that. And very importantly, we have a very special guest today. He is one of my personal favorite film critics. I've been following his reviews for a while, and he is also the co-host of the Alternate Ending podcast, which is a very fun podcast. So why don't you talk a little bit about it? Tim Braden, thank you for being here.
Hi, thank you guys so much for having me on. I'm really, really excited to be here. I don't know that I have much else to say besides what you just did, but yeah, I write reviews and co-host a podcast at alternateending.com. We just sort of talk about movies generally, no real thematic focus, although we tend to do top five lists as kind of our way of organizing our thoughts as we dive through. But yeah, I try to review most things I can get my hands on. Right now I happen to be working my way very slowly through the career of Ingmar Bergman. So if that's your jam, please come on and check that out.
Very on brand for the Criterion Project.
Very true. Very true. I mean, in part because of that big old Criterion box, that is why I'm doing it. So
yes, definitely. Listeners, Tim's podcast is really, really a lot of fun. And his website, Alternate Ending, is a wonderful website. Actually, yours has been published on that website. So if you want to read my writing, you can go over there.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So thank you for being here, Tim. Before we get into our discussion, on top of all these amazing things that you do, we also hear that you are an animation scholar. So Rachel and I are actually big fans of animation. So we are very interested to hear what is your specialty in your studies.
Well, I will try to make this short. The danger of ever asking an academic to talk about their work is that they might actually do it. But I'll give you sort of the elevator pitch version of what I'm working on. So I'm really interested in how depth is created in animation, because it's fundamentally a two-dimensional thing. It's not, you know, like when you're shooting a movie and you take a camera out, you're taking a three-dimensional event, you're putting it onto film, and then you're sort of letting the audience read back in three-dimensional depth cues. Animation, of course, you're working to something that's flat, its entire existence. So I'm looking at sort of three eras of animation, Disney in the 1930s, Miyazaki in the 1990s and early 2000s, and then Pixar sort of for the first 15 years or so of its existence, and just kind of studying how are these films representing depth, and how are they representing three-dimensional space, and like what are the different strategies based on changing technology, based on the kind of the different sorts of animation, like hand-drawn versus computer-generated. That's kind of where I'm at. It's just like really doing a deep, deep dive into, right now I'm specifically working on Mickey Mouse cartoons from the 30s and how they're sort of working with that way.
So is this like for a PhD or something like that, or just
this is my dissertation project? Yeah. Mm. This is at the end of this, hopefully I will have some letters after my name.
Nice.
Oh, incredible. That was music to my ears, Tim. this sounds like a paper or dissertation rather that I would love to read. But I think it's time to move on to our regular segments of the show. Before we get into the host, we always go around and talk a little bit about what we've been watching on the Criterion channel. So Rachel, would you like to go first? Have you been seeing some stuff?
Yes. So I was able to watch the, what's the year? I was able to watch The Secret Garden with Margaret O'Brien. And this is from 1949. And it was interesting. I mean, I love the story. So it's kind of one of those things that's a little bit hard to do wrong. And it's not bad, but she is very strange in this movie. she was kind of, I mean, she was a slightly like horror movie child. Like what is happening? Like she was just very, very blunt, I guess, in her delivery. And it's always hard because Mary Lennox is supposed to be kind of a brat as the movie begins, and then she changes through the garden and everything. But I don't know, she was just so mechanical kind of in her delivery that it was sort of fascinating to me. So I enjoyed watching it. It's definitely not my favorite version. There's of course a new version this year, which I enjoyed. I liked it. The version from 1993 is one of the best. It's really good. So that's what I watched this week.
Interesting. I know nothing about The Secret Garden. Are you familiar, Tim?
So my Criterion viewing tends to be centered on what's about to expire, just because like there's so much on the channel. And The Secret Garden has been on my radar as like, oh, I need to get to that before the month is over. So I certainly know the film exists and know it's out there. I have not seen it. So I'm, based on what you've just said, I'm not sure if I feel like I need to rush out and make that happen or not.
No, it's a very strange performance, in my opinion, at least.
No, Margaret O'Brien, I'm fascinated with her. She's like a very strange child actress.
Yes,
she's always like at 110% in everything.
Yeah. Like in Meet Me in St. Louis, she's definitely a lot, but she's like still sort of cute in her trauma.
Here she's probably like adolescent. She's probably like 12 years old at this point, right?
Something like that, yeah.
Oh,
and she's just kind of like, how dare you go into my garden? What are you like, what? I don't know. So it was an experience to watch. But have you seen the 93? Version, I think it's 93.
The one version from the 90s. Yeah.
Isn't it? I love it. I think it's really good.
Yeah, no, it's really, really, really good kids movie.
Great. Yeah. So Tim, have you been watching something that you'd like to share?
I'm gonna cheat slightly. This is a movie I've seen several times. I haven't just watched it, but I love it, and I'm gonna use this opportunity to proselytize for it a little bit. Criterion added a whole bunch of 70s horror films this past month to celebrate the impending Halloween holiday. And one of the films in that list is Theater of Blood from 1973, which is a Vincent Price vehicle that I just absolutely adore it. It's one of several Vincent Price movies that came out in the late 60s and early 70s, all of which are basically, what if Vincent Price is kind of a combination of Jason Voorhees and Dr. Mabusa? So it's like, he's this kind of crazy genius who gets slighted and then creates really complicated death traps to kill the people who've like wronged him. And in this particular case, he's playing a very terrible Shakespearean actor named Edward Lionheart, who was so distressed over the terrible, terrible reviews he's received and this sort of humiliation he's received from critics that he fakes his own suicide. And then 2 years later, starting on the Ides of March, he begins killing his critics in Shakespearean inspired deaths. So it's like this silly, kitschy, like slasher movie joke for people who love Shakespeare a whole lot, and as both a fan of slashers and Shakespeare, it's kind of like directly in my my pleasure center. And Vincent Price is always just like, it's like asking him to be as hammy and over the top as he can in a very purposeful way. And it's just, it's extremely delightful. So it's one of those things where if you like Vincent Price, this is kind of as much Vincent Price as you will ever get in a single movie.
Wow.
And it has been blessed by Criterion. So I'm like, all right, I will go with that.
That sounds great. I haven't done as much horror movie watching this month as I usually try to in October because I've been busy with other stuff, but I want to rectify that this last week. So I'll definitely be checking that out. It sounds
like the whole of all of the 70s horror films, they did a really good job curating that list. So I feel like you can't really go wrong.
So let me ask you something. Rachel here doesn't do very well with gore. So how would you say this Theater of Blood ranks in that area?
You know, it's hard to say. It is certainly bloody. It's not like Saw bloody. I mean, it's definitely a 70s movie for a mass audience. Like, this is not for like Fangoria watchers or anything, but there is blood in it. It's such a silly movie that to me it doesn't even really register as like upsetting or scary. Mm-hmm. It's more just kind of like over the top. Mm-hmm. So it's like a parody of gore almost.
Yeah, because I can handle some blood when it is over the top like that. Like we reviewed Kronos a couple of episodes ago where there's some sort of gory aspects to that, but it's so unrealistic that, or like I enjoy a good like Dracula movie or something like that. Yeah. So that sounds really fun. I like Vincent Price, so.
I mean, it's if you like Vincent Price, I think you owe it to yourself. I will say the one moment that might be a little bit too much if you're not great with gore, since it is based on Shakespeare, one of the murders invariably or had to be from Titus Andronicus. Mm. And that one is a little bit on the far edge of gross. Okay. But
right. Sounds about right.
You will definitely know when that one's coming, so you could possibly like excuse yourself in the room for 5 minutes.
Okay. So now look down, cover my eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I have been continuing my project with trying to watch the Albert Brooks movies, which I've been doing for a while, and I kind of fell off, but then they're leaving at the end of the month, so I'm trying to catch up. And I just watched Lost in America last night, which is which was a lot of fun, which is about like Albert Brooks plays this kind of yuppie ad exec who decides that he doesn't get a promotion that he wants, so he decides to leave it all and take his money and like quit his job and with his wife just like drive around America and really like get to learn themselves. And so of course the first place they go, as you would if you're doing this kind of thing, is to Las Vegas, Nevada, which is where they lose all their money and everything goes, you know, in the toilet. But I thought it was a very funny movie. Either of you guys seen Lost in America?
I haven't, believe it or not. And I should because I love Albert Brooks, but I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I have seen this film. I've seen all of Albert Brooks's features. I'm a crazy huge fan. And I think this one is not his best, but it's certainly way up there for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had a lot of fun with it, especially everything at the casino. And Gary Marshall, who plays the casino owner, I guess, in a very, very funny scene where he's trying to, Albert Brooks, they lost all their money and he's trying to get their money back.
Do you have a favorite? If you've seen them all, what's your favorite of Albert Brooks?
Oh, for me? Mm-hmm. Probably Modern Romance, although it's also probably his like most bleak-hearted film, which is kind of what I like in my comedy. I would say like Lost in America is, it's the best combination of like purely funny while also being really kind of smart and cynical, because I think his later films are more funny and his early films are more cynical. This is kind of a good mix of those two modes.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. It's very funny all the way through, but there is this undercurrent of like, obviously these characters are doing ridiculous, very poor judgment things. And
yeah, it's definitely a satire of like upper middle class white people who think they can just kind of like blunder through the world and never face consequences for doing so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a very funny, very cynical ending to the movie. Before we move on, Tim, what's your take on Albert Brooks Real Life, because that's the one that surprised me the most, and I think it might be my favorite.
I like it quite a lot. It's definitely, in order to fully dig into it, I think you need to do some research on it, because like a lot of what it's doing is a parody of a really specific moment in 70s pop culture. I do think, in a lot of ways, my favorite version of Albert Brooks is the one where he's kind of taking himself to task, and like the humor's kind of built on Albert Brooks as this constructed personality who's just really arrogant and unpleasant, and we enjoy watching him get taken down. And he's doing a really, really good job of that in real life, like sort of playing himself, but this fictional version of himself who's just this awful egotist.
Yeah.
And I love that.
Definitely. Great. Okay, I think it's about time we get into the main topic of the episode. So, The Host, 2006, Bong Joon-ho. Would I be correct in saying kind of his breakout movie into the international stage? I feel like maybe, Tim, you were a little bit more in the zeitgeist back then. You were already writing reviews.
Right. It felt to me when this came out, and it came out in the United States in early 2007, I forget exactly when, but it really felt like all the genre fans, like people who followed monster movies, people who followed horror movies, really, really were responding to this. Critics certainly were super excited about it. So in that respect, I think I would call it his breakthrough, although it also feels like he broke through and then kind of receded a little bit, like he kind of had to go to the film festivals to see his next couple things. So I think he broke through, but then he had to sort of break through a second time with Snowpiercer. That makes sense.
That sounds about right. So who would like to give like a little bit of a plot description of what happens in this movie? I don't know if I'm totally up to the task, so I'm bringing this to the table. Rachel, would you like to give it a stab?
So basically, it starts out where the water in the river has been contaminated by all these chemicals that the Americans are putting into the water. And there is this mutated creature that comes from all of these chemicals, and this man who runs this little snack bar kiosk thing, that he and his father are kind of, they find this big this creature, and then they're kind of on the run from the creature along with his two daughters, and it's basically a creature scares movie about everybody kind of fighting off this mutated creature. Is that, that fair?
I think so. I mean, it's important, I guess, to say that the young daughter gets kind of kidnapped by trapped by the monster, and then the rest of the family, who are different levels of incompetent, try to save her. Right?
Yep.
Well, because it's I mean, Bong Joon-ho's thing, and we all saw this very, very visibly with Parasite this past year. He loves smashing genres together, and he's actually kind of smashing the same genres together he did in Parasite, which is we have like this kind of lightly comic family drama plus a thriller, in this case a giant monster movie, plus a political satire, I'd say, because it's very explicitly an American, like the American military had polluted the river and therefore triggered all of the rest of what happens.
Yeah, totally. And definitely a sense in both of those movies of like a critique of America, or like almost, you know, that's also in Parasite, I feel, the way the rich family is kind of modeling itself after a sort of a vaguely American identity. And here we see it with the military and all that stuff. So what did you guys think of the movie?
I really enjoyed it. I love creature scares movies. That's the one kind of part of horror that I really is probably my favorite. That even movies that other people don't like, I tend to enjoy. Like, I really enjoyed 47 Meters Down. I thought that was fun. I like I love Crawl. This obviously has a bit more of like a supernatural element a little bit because it's this mutated creature. But I don't know. I just had a good time with it. I didn't feel like I had a ton of great insight, but I thought it was really fun.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Tim?
I mean, I'm kind of in the same boat. I really, really love just giant monster movies in general, monster movies, whether they're giant or not, really. And this is a really, really good version of one. And it's, mm-hmm. it came, I mean, I think that the giant monster movies heyday was kind of not the 2000s, basically, to put it lightly. And I think having this film just kind of spring out in the 2000s, kind of without anyone expecting it, made it feel really, really like a huge treat at the time. And I think it holds up. I've watched this film several times at this point since 2007, and it's always really, really satisfying. It really scratches that itch, in part because I think, unlike a lot of giant monster movies, it really does have a good character story. It has characters who I'm interested in following and whose like fate matters to me, mm-hmm. which is where a lot of these films, even like the very good Godzilla films, do tend to kind of lose steam when they're focusing on the people in the film. And this one I don't think does.
That's a very good point. And I think, that's definitely a strength, I think, of Bong Joon-ho. And something I think that, I don't know if you guys will agree with this, but I feel that something that makes him different from like how maybe an American mainstream director would approach these subjects that he puts in his movies is he's always so interested in an ensemble of people. You know, like I feel a lot of the time, maybe because of the Star Wars hero's journey influence, American movies tend to focus very much on one protagonist. Maybe not so much in monster features, but like, you know, I feel like Bong, even when he's doing more protagonist-centric stories, there's always a constellation of characters that are moving the plot forward. I don't know if you guys agree with
that. I can see that. It's basically an ensemble film.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I want to even push back against something that wasn't your point at all a little bit. You said maybe it's different in a giant monster movie. And I think actually, like, if you look at the American Godzilla from whenever that was, 2014, I think, one of the problems with that film is that it's trying to focus on a single protagonist, and they picked a bad protagonist to do that with. So I do think that there is a real sense in which I think it is a very Hollywood thing to assume a film needs one protagonist and then all the other characters sort of rotate around that person. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right. Bong Joon-ho is so great at constructing these big ensembles. And we say that in all of his films, really. This one, Parasite, obviously, but also in Snowpiercer and Okja, those have like more constellations of characters than I think individuals that we're following throughout every scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, when I compare it to the gods and monsters, Godzilla, whatever that the
King
one
of the monsters.
King of the Monsters, yeah. That movie I hated. It was so like you couldn't see what anything was happening because there all the obfuscation on the screen. There was all the rain and it's just crazy. Like in trying to make a spectacle. They ruined the spectacle, at least in my opinion, because it was just, I don't know, it was just hard to even, the way that they had it edited and the way they were splicing everything so that it was supposed to be from the ground so that you were looking up at it, but then everything was cut so badly that there was no sense of scope or scale. And I look at something like this, which obviously has a way smaller budget, and this was so much more fun, and I could see the character. And I got a feel for this character, and it was just so much better than I feel like spectacle entertainment is often done over here.
This is great because I wanted to touch and ask you both of you about the visual effects in this movie because this is from the mid 2000s when there was a lot of CGI being used in ways maybe that were a little premature. Let's say that way. And especially in non-American productions, a lot of the time we had very, very bad CGI. But I feel like the CG in this movie, despite being a little bit dated, works very well. And especially in the context of 2006. I don't know, what do you think about that?
Yeah,
go ahead.
I agree. I think you can see it. It's clear and it looks pretty, it's certainly realistic enough for me to get immersed in the story, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. Like, I think the film knows the limitations of its CGI, which is always really, really important. It's not just like, hey, we can do this over and over again. It is, I think, being judicious in showing us CGI effects when it has to, not when it can. And I think that helps. I do think that it's showing its age for sure. And even in 2006, 2007, it was not state of the art. For sure. I mean, as you point out, like American studios tended to have just an unfair advantage because they could just throw money at visual effects. And of course, this movie does not have a Hollywood budget, and it just, there's no way around that. So the effects, I think, are not necessarily as good as the best of 2006, but at the same token, because it couldn't just go hog wild with effects because it didn't have the budget to do so, I do think that it doesn't feel like it has aged as badly as a lot of things from 2006 have, just because it's not as much CGI to really call attention to itself. And I think the monster itself as a CGI effect is really good, in part because it's a slimy, wet thing. So if it feels kind of shiny and too overlit, that actually fits. And again, that's, I think, sort of working with the limitations of CGI rather than...
Totally. I think that's a great call, the having it be a water monster so that it's always shiny and you don't get that as much of that CGI, you know, thing that takes you out of it. The only moment that I would say that really didn't hold up for me is when they light the monster on fire, which I think it was just such a hard thing to do back at that time, is convey fire with CGI. We've gotten a little
fire
bit...
Fire effects, yeah. Fire effects were took forever for them to like figure out. Like one of the last things that were good in CGI, I think.
Yeah, and even then,
that's true.
It looks bad in the close-up, but there's also this shot where it's kind of the monsters on fire blurry in the background, and then in the foreground we have Duna Bae, who is in focus and walking away from the monster, and that looks great, you know? So they, even then, they knew how to use their limitations and work around them a little bit. What do you guys think makes a great monster? Because I was thinking of this watching the movie of how do you, because, okay, this is something that happened to me recently. We drove out to Long Island because we needed a day out of the city in this pandemic. And we ended up at this park by the beach and there were some seagulls. And you know, seagull is not a very huge creature, although they're pretty big birds. And I was like, it felt like a weird kind of danger to being close to this bird, even though it's just a bird that's probably more scared of me than I am of them. And it felt so strange than watching a monster movie, because so we're like so used to it. Like, how do you convey how weirdly threatening it is to be in the presence of a creature, you know, in a movie? I don't know if you guys have thoughts on that.
I think a big part of it is the unpredictability, in that it's not scary if a animal can be tamed and is predictable, but when it becomes a monster is when it's unpredictable and we don't know what it's going to do.
So you're thinking that like how the monster behaves in the movie is like the kind of thing that will give that. Yeah, I'm thinking of the moment where the girl tries to jump on the monster, and then the monster seems like they're not doing anything, but then she's trapped in his tentacle. I think that moment is so good, and that really conveyed to me like that what you're talking about.
Because if you think about it, like a dog for the most part isn't scary when we know what they're going to do and we have a relationship with this dog, and you know, it's a friendly dog. But if it's all of a sudden an unpredictable dog and we don't know what it's going to do, and then all of a sudden it can become scary.
Tim, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point, that there does need to be some sense. It needs to feel like a wild animal, I think, tends to work. So I think that's a really good point. I find that as I'm thinking about this, every single rule I want to say, like, well, a good monster is this, I can think of a counterexample. So I'm going to try to avoid like making grand theories of what makes a good movie monster and kind of just focus on this movie monster. I think a big part of it is that it makes sense as an organic, like, entity. Like, it feels like when you see this monster doing what it's doing, it makes sense biologically. Like, it makes sense. This is an animal that mutated in a certain way. It doesn't feel like anything's extraneous just to, like, look creepy or cool or do, like, a fun gore effect or whatever, which is, I think, something that happens with a lot of movie monsters. It feels like it evolved, or mutated rather, to, like, be the way it is. So it does feel plausible. And I think plausibility matters. Like, I think it needs to feel like something that could really exist. And then going back to the characters, I think a big part of it is, and this is true of so many movies with so many different kinds of effects-driven storytelling, whether it's giant monsters or disaster movies or whatever, the characters need to react to it in a way that convinces me of the threat. And the characters need to sort of bring me in. They are my vessel for how I am going to react to the monster. And I think this film does a really, really good job of that.
Yeah. Definitely. And it does a great job of having each of the four main characters, I would say, in the family who are searching for the kid to react in their own specific ways. Yeah. Definitely.
And so they all feel like they're all in the same movie. One of the things I didn't like about Kong Skull Island was I felt like all of the characters were all in different movies. I felt like Samuel L. Jackson's character was in a revenge movie, and then you had like the military guy, and Brie Larson, what was she doing? Like, they all felt like they were in different movies to me. And in this case, all four of the characters are different and their responses are different, but they all feel like they're all in this same movie.
That's a really great point. I completely agree with that.
So the last thing I have before we go into our usual questions, and I don't know how much, I couldn't help, of course, to notice the parallels between this movie and kind of the pandemic moment that we're living. Obviously, this was done many, many years before the current moment. Well, not that many, but, you know, about 20-ish. Do we have any thoughts about that? We touched a little bit on the kind of the way that the movie is a critique of American, I guess, interventionism is what I would say. Like, you know, this came at the time of when the Iraq war was still kind of going really strongly. So that feels very pointed. But anything else in that area that we'd like to touch on?
I mean, I think it kind of goes into the idea of group thought, and that the way that sort of misinformation can spread throughout from one person to another person to another person. So I definitely think that you have some of that going on. You know, there's a lot of all the whole culture of fake news and all of that. I think you can see some of that here in this film.
And what I was going to say, it's tough for me to like go too far in speculating on like undercurrents in the film, because it's a South Korean film. It matters that it's a South Korean film. I don't personally know that much about South Korean culture and politics. It's like, I'm sure there are resonances there that I'm just not picking up. But I do think it's interesting, specifically thinking about it in terms of the pandemic. South Korea was one of the countries that got through the pandemic with sort of the fewest number of deaths, in a lot of ways, a very low disruption to sort of the ordinary structure of society. And I do think, as sort of an example of here's how a South Korean family reacts to a crisis, it kind of speaks to, you know, we've kind of touched on why this would not be an American film, and maybe that kind of gets us to the question of how different countries react to crises in different ways generally. Again, I'd be super uncomfortable generalizing that, because I just don't know that much about South Korean culture, but it does feel like there's something that you could tease out there, I think.
Yeah. That's very interesting. And that's something that I think I do love a lot about Bong Joon-ho's way of writing and making movies, that definitely have a very specifically Korean subtext to them. And even though, like, I agree with you, Tim, I don't know all the specifics because I don't know that much about South Korean history, but I can tell, and you get enough that you get a sense that something here is happening that I just don't know what it is, but it has significance. And at the same time, it is made for a very broad audience to enjoy, you know, as much as they were always festival art house movies, they're also very mainstream appealing, you know, like blockbusters, basically. Almost all of his movies are in like a blockbuster genre. And I think that's very special to be able to combine those two things.
True. Yeah, which we could ask our pretentiousness scale question now. That's a perfect segue.
Oh, yeah, sure. Or should we maybe say, why does this belong in the Criterion? What makes this a Criterion film? I guess what I just said is basically my argument for what makes Bong Joon-ho a special Criterion-worthy subject, let's say. So what do you guys think? Rachel, would you like to go first? What do you think makes this a Criterion movie?
Yeah, I think because it is a standout film from a particular country and a filmmaker like Bong Joon-ho, I think that's why it would qualify as a Criterion film, something different. They like to have a variety in their releases.
Yeah. How about you, Tim?
I mean, I want to just co-sign what you said, Conrado. I think it really does do all of these things that are more than worthy of Criterion acclamation. And there's also, I think, a sense in which this was a really significant international release during the spread of the Korean New Wave in the 2000s. Like, it got a lot of eyeballs. I think this was the most popular Korean film outside of Korea when it opened. And that's certainly important, and importance, like, sort of in that sense, is one of the things Criterion talks about. But there's also the pragmatic issue of, you know, as Rachel points out, there's a lot of different genres that the collection likes to dabble in, and they have released giant monster movies. Their release number 1000 was a big old set of Godzilla films, like all the Godzilla films made up through 1975. And some of those movies are just real bad. So, like, if they can have, like, you know, whatever, Godzilla, Son of Godzilla, or All Monsters Attack, or Godzilla versus Megalon can be in the Criterion Collection, surely a monster movie as good and rich in its characters and sort of interesting in the society it's depicting as the host, surely that could be in the Criterion Collection.
Very well said. So let's talk about the pretentious scale then. This is where we try to rank a movie in the pretension, thinking of, you know, the Criterion customer or viewer. So from 1 to 10, have we ever done a 0? I don't know if we have even, but.
Yeah, I think it's 1 to 10. Yeah.
So from 1 to 10, yeah, we I guess we just assume that if it's on Criterion, it's impossible to be a 0. So where do we think that this movie ranks in the Criterion scale? Maybe Tim, you would like to start, or would you like us to give you a little bit?
I can start. I can take a stab here, and hopefully won't completely break your scale. So I think there's always going to be that little thing of there are people for whom. Well, subtitled means it's pretentious. So we have to give it at least a couple points for that. And I do think anything that's trying to elevate a genre, and this is elevating in a way, the monster movie, I think that adds a few things. But at the same time, we're watching a giant mutant catfish terrorize Seoul. And that's just a good time. You know, that's crack open a beer, sit and watch your friends and have a good time. So I'm going to call this, so if 10 is the most pretentious, I'm going to call this a 4. I think.
Oh, okay. Wow. Mm-hmm. All right. Rachel, what do you think about this?
I actually agree. I was going to give it a 4 for pretty much the same reasons. We're on the same brainwave with that, with this one.
Oh, good. I'm glad that I mm-hmm. figured out what the scale was for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you guys, your reasoning is really on point. And I agree. It's basically the same reasons or the same things that I had rumbling in my head. I was going to go with like a 5 or a 6 though. So, but you know, I think the reasoning is there and maybe a little tricky because, I don't know. I think that's what makes, like I said, I'm just repeating myself, but that's what makes, to me, Bunk so special, is his ability to mix these things. So I almost wanted to put him right at the middle of the scale to signify all that. But I will take your number fours. That sounds pretty accurate to me. Which leads us into, yes, our world famous remake segment. So Rachel, I think you had a remake that you wanted to pitch to us ready.
Yeah. So I was trying to think of somebody because I hate it when I feel like it never works out when international directors do an English version of their film. It seems like it almost never is good. And I'd hate that to happen to Bong. And so what I was thinking of is, who is a director that has sort of can have horror elements and make it funny and could kind of pull off all the different dynamics. And so I thought of Edgar Wright would be a good person to make a new version of The Host. He could make it funny. He's good at doing sort of ensemble, you know, horror comedies. He's done a whole bunch. And so I think it would be a pretty straightforward adaptation, but of course you could update the visual effects and I think he would kind of get some fun banter, make it entertaining. And so that was my pitch for a remake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I guess it would be interesting to me to see one of these American remakes of foreign language movies be made by someone who has a distinct style of Edgar Wright, and who maybe they will let actually put that style into the movie. Sounds like something that it's not likely to happen, but you know, someone can dream.
It could be something fresh and new, as opposed to feeling like, oh, it's just a remake, why not just watch the original?
Yeah, I guess that's the tricky thing about these remake section, but that's also kind of the fun of it, is that it's sometimes it's just kind of ridiculous to try to pitch a remake of these Criterion classic movies. But Tim, would you like to take a stab at it?
I think I would. They'd announced a remake of this after the film came and did pretty well for a foreign film at the US box office. They announced that there was going to be a remake, which was going to be produced but not directed by Gore Verbinski. Oh. And part of me is like, ooh, Gore Verbinski would be a good director. And he, at no point, was going to direct. It was going to be directed by a first-timer, I think. And of course, the project fell apart. And it's, I think, in development hell still. I don't think they've given up on it entirely. And surely post-Parasite, people are going to be returning to Bong Joon-ho stuff. But my thought would be the way to remake it, and I wasn't necessarily thinking in terms of like a filmmaker, more in terms of an approach. I think if we're going to do, say, an American version, and I'm just assuming that this would be an American remake, the sort of quintessentially American genre that I think The Host kind of points towards is like message movies about the environment. And I'm thinking about things like Dark Water, that Todd Haynes film with Mark Ruffalo that came out last year, or like an Aaron Brockovich or something like that. That's kind of about like environmental impact is sort of literalized through this monster. So I would kind of want to see it done that way, done as like a sort of really, initially at least, a really straightforward kind of Oscar bait about like environmental impact that then gets interrupted by this giant monster movie. So, you know, find a director who can do that sort of low-key indie vibe, but is willing to work in sort of this more visual effects driven mode. And the other thing that kind of leapt to mind a little bit, in the 1970s, the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland was so polluted that it kept catching on fire. And part of me is like, that would be a good setting for this. So maybe while I'm daydreaming, make it a period film set in 1970s Cleveland.
Wow. Could we combine our pitches and have Edgar Wright?
I feel like we absolutely could.
Yes.
I think he would actually be really, really good for my approach. Yeah. So I think so. I like that.
Wow, this sounds excellent. This I would love to see. I love the idea of something that begins as this Oscar Beatty and Brockovich type thing, and then turns into a monster movie. That's like just the kind of genre mashup that I love. Certainly much more inspired than my remake pitch, which is a total cop-out. I was just going to say, make it a remake and get Bong to direct it, but then just leave Bong alone to do whatever he wants and make something that has nothing to do with the movie. And just, you know, give him the blank check now that he's an Oscar-winning director. So yeah, I feel like that's, looking back,
I mean, creative. I feel like that's a good pitch in that it involves giving Bong Joon-ho a blank check, which I am 100% on board with, regardless of what the project is. So
yeah, I'm a fan of that. I just feel like, I don't know. I can't think of any off the top of my head, but it just seems like every time, I just feel like I've heard so many times being like, it was directed by the same person who made the foreign original and it's terrible. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's happened a ton of times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is very true. So that's what I think. Well, I mean, we know that Bong can work in English because he's done, I mean, I like both Okja and Snowpiercer a lot. So, yeah. I really hope, and I think this is probably going to happen for sure, that he gets a big fat check from Hollywood to do something crazy soon.
Yeah, I think so.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that's it for us at the Criterion Project this time around. Tim, thank you so much for being here. This was delightful.
Thank you for having me. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks for coming. Should I say real quick what we are going to talk about next time?
Yes, please, Rachel.
Okay, so I it was my month to pick, or my week to pick. So I decided to go with the 1934 version of The Scarlet Pimpernel. I've never seen it, but I love the one from the 1980s, and I love the book. And so I just thought that would be fun to finally watch this the original version, original adaptation. So that's mm-hmm. what we're gonna talk about next time.
Yeah, and like I told Rachel when she told me about this idea, is I know nothing about the Scarlet Pimpernel except that it was parodied by Daffy Duck. but I am looking forward to it. Tim, do you have any familiarity with the movie or the book?
Honestly, I'm also pretty much at, well, I know Daffy Duck parodied it.
Well, there we go.
That's mm-hmm. that's where I can get.
Great. Well, again, thank you, Tim, for joining us. And please, would you like to tell our listeners where they can find you and all your great work?
Sure. So I am at alternateending.com, alternate ending, all one word with two E's in the middle. I blog, I podcast occasionally, very, very rarely do video work. But yeah, we try to update at least once or twice a day with some sort of new video or text content. So alternateending.com.
Wonderful. And I do want to say for the listeners that, Tim, you are probably one of the most productive film critics, reviewers that I've ever seen.
Thank you. I try to be.
Yeah, the pace at which you publish reviews is really, and such good reviews too, is very, very...
Thank you. It's a good way to procrastinate from doing my academic writing, which is, I think, one of the reasons
Oh, yeah. I bet. All right, so Rachel, where can people find you?
Yes, you can find me at Rachel's Reviews, all over social media, and on iTunes and YouTube, and on Rotten Tomatoes. Check that out. Also, Hallmarkies Podcast is getting going. We have our first set of Christmas movies happening this weekend. Really excited about it. So lots of stuff going on there. We're going to have interviews. We're going to have an extremely, extremely busy season. So make sure to follow us at the Hallmarkies Podcast.
Great. And you can find me on Twitter at Coco Hits New York, where you can find, I'm constantly tweeting about all the stuff that I'm trying to plug and get you people to read or watch. So just follow me there and I can assure you, you'll hear about it. And also please take some time to give us a 5-star rating and review us on Apple yes. Podcasts. That's going to really help our show reach as many people as possible.
Yeah. And you can follow us at Criterion Pod on Twitter.
That's absolutely right. Okay. Thank you, everybody. That was a great conversation. And I'll see you guys next time.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.
It's the Criterion. It's the Criterion. 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 And Criterion.